Get ready for a high adventure with the new children's adventure series, The Only Living Boy. Harvey Award winners David Gallagher and Steve Ellis' critically acclaimed web series to print is now a riveting graphic novel exclusively from Papercuts. When Eric runs away from home, he finds himself lost, without his memory, on a patchwork planet under a broken moon. He may be the only living boy, but he's not alone. The world is filled with dangerous creatures fighting to decide who is the hunter and who is the hunted. He'll need help from mermaid warrior Morgan and Thea, an insect princess, to escape the foes pitted against them by the dreaded Lord Balakar and fiendish Dr. Once. Can Eric defeat their evil plans and find his way home? Mental Floss calls The Only Living Boy an all-ages adventure book inspired by pulp serials, Saturday morning cartoons, Jack Kirby, and even the music of Paul Simon. The Only Living Boy, Volume 1, Prisoner of the Patchwork Planet, is on sale in bookstores everywhere on March 8th. Learn more at olbcomic.com.
My name is Robert Hawkins. Approximately 7 hours ago, something attacked the city. You found this. If you're watching this, then you know more about it than I do. Hello? Beth? Beth, where are you?
Hey, we cannot go into the middle of the city! We gotta get out of here!
There's nothing you can do for now!
Do you know what that thing is?
Whatever it is, it's winning.
Do you have any idea what's out there?
I don't care what's out there. Listen to me. She's dying.
Turn that camera.
Rob, I saw it. Rob, it's alive.
How it all went down.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Film and Water Podcast, part of the Fire and Water Network of Podcasts. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, of course, and joining me again is Chris Cummins from Sci-Fi Explosion. Chris, thank you for coming back to the show.
Thanks again for having me back. This is going to be fun.
Yes, Chris was on just 2 weeks ago, and we're in the middle of preparing our Karen Allen spinoff show. But before we can get to that, this movie that we're going to talk about tonight is Cloverfield from 2008. This was on the list of movies Chris wanted to talk about. And this was one of those ones that I saw in the theater, you know, at the time, and I thought, that's a pretty good movie. Yeah, it isn't something that I would put on any great list of mine or something I really remembered all that much. But I was like, we'll give that a shot. And then I watched it over the weekend again in preparation for this episode. And I was like, this is a terrific movie. This is like, so thank you, Chris, for inspiring me to watch this over again. Because obviously with the sequel coming out, perfect time. But man, I really enjoyed watching it the second time. So Chris, like, why is this on this? Why was that on the list of movies you really wanted to talk about?
Before this movie came out, I wasn't a fan of the found footage films. I weirdly enough, I missed Blair Witch during its initial run.
Oh wow!
So I didn't see Blair Witch until like 2011, and then I saw it and I was in love with it, and I was walking around telling everyone like, "Hey, have you seen Blair Witch?" And they were all like, "Yeah, I saw it 15 years ago."
Hey Chris, the guy at the end of the Crying Game is a dude.
Yeah, right. It was just like that. So the found footage genre was something like I went to film school and I went to film school at Temple, and when I was there, everyone for their student projects was doing found footage movies.
Sure.
And this was in 1997. So, you know, I was kind of burnt out on the whole found footage thing when Blair Witch came out. So I didn't really want you know, I kind of had this weird kind of irrational aversion to found footage movies, which was because I just loathed film school. But so when Cloverfield came out, I was really taken by the marketing. And at that point, I had enough faith in J.J. Abrams to know that, like, this is going to be something interesting. I don't know exactly what this is going to be. Obviously, I'm a fan of monster movies, but the movie came out. It was marketed really well, and it was the first movie that I felt had really perfected the found footage formula.
Yeah, I think when I saw it, I came at it in the theater of like, yeah, found footage. Well, I wasn't as sick of it in 2008 as I would be now. Now, if I hear a movie's found footage, I'm just like, pass, you know.
Right.
But yeah, it really does do something interesting. For anyone who hasn't seen it or is not familiar, basically the IMDb summary is: a group of friends venture deep into the streets of New York on a rescue mission during a rampaging monster attack. It stars Michael Stahl, David. I may give you these character names. It doesn't mean anything. Michael Stahl, right. David, T.J. Miller. Is the guy running the camera, Deadpool's best pal, is the guy holding the camera through most of it. Jessica Lucas, Lizzie Kaplan, and Odette Annibal, although I think at the time she was billed as Odette Yustman. And yeah, I mean, the first couple minutes, or maybe 15 or 20 minutes, it's just a party. It's the guy Rob, played Michael Stahl David, has taken a job overseas, and he's about to leave, so he's getting thrown a farewell party. And you're kind of just like, all right, where's this going? You know, I mean, right. Not much seems to be happening. And then all of a sudden there's an explosion a couple of blocks over in New York City, and there's a loud rumble, and you initially hear the news reports think it's an earthquake, and then all hell breaks loose, and it becomes clear that a giant alien monster has attacked New York City. And these couple of friends have to run through New York City to escape. What Rob wants to do is reach his girlfriend, who he calls on his cell phone and finds that she is trapped under some rubble. And he wants to get across New York City to rescue her. And that's really his main goal. And that's the whole film. You know, really what happens to them. And, you know, it's directed by Matt Reeves. It was produced by J.J. Abrams. And, you know, like I said, it is just really terrific. It's gripping. It feels real. It feels to me what probably it would be like, because all the power goes out. There's looting immediately, of course. It's a really very gripping, and you know, it's like at 95 minutes. It's paced very well. I mean, there's no music in it at all.
Right.
It you know, thankfully we'll never know what it feels like, knock on wood, but it pretty much feels like I would imagine what that would go down like if that really happened.
Yeah, the movie, when it was released, it definitely got some controversy as a kind of 9/11 exploitation film, because there's a lot of imagery in it, such as, like, you know, the dust clouds after the Statue of Liberty goes down the street, and just, like, everyone walking around in confusion and things like that, and to the news reports on the television, and how people are learning about the monster attack and what's going on there. And I kind of see the criticism of that, especially, you know, living on the East Coast. It definitely was kind of still, you know, a very raw nerve, as it is still to this day. But, you know, what it gave to the movie was an urgency that this is this incredibly fantastical thing that's happening in the movie, but it feels real because of it's being informed by recent history. So that was kind of an interesting aspect of the film that doesn't really get too much play. And it just builds the reality of this movie, where there's this absurd thing happening in the Cloverfield monster attacking everyone. So I feel like it's really interesting to that aspect in that, you know, you have these characters who are kind of relatable, but they're not very well developed, because it's not important that they be. What's important is that you follow them as they're trying to get to their friend and avoid getting attacked by the monster.
Yeah, I mean, the whole movie is a flashback. It opens up with that what you're about to see is footage that has been shot, and you forget about that very quickly.
Remains of Central Park.
You know, right.
The area formerly as Central Park. So you know shit's going to be bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this movie, the one moment that's probably the most iconic, and this is referenced on the poster, because on the poster you see the headless Statue of Liberty, is when there's an explosion and then the head of the Statue of Liberty lands on a New York street and slides down and crashes into some cars. And, you know, on the one hand, that's gutsy because there is one sci-fi film that pretty much owns the Statue of Liberty as its iconic imagery. Yeah. So to me, for another movie to use it is pretty gutsy, but it is that kind of like, you know, if you were sitting on the street and you saw that happen, your mind would scarcely be able to comprehend what you're looking at, that the Statue of Liberty, his head has just landed right in front of you.
Yeah, and then it's such a great and well-done sequence, and then immediately when it goes into that, I mean, the movie just does not let up. And there's a lot of really effective things, like when they're watching the news reports on television, and that's the way that both the characters and the audience is getting kind of getting the information delivered about the scope of these attacks and what's going on. I was reading up on the movie, and obviously, as both of us being Carpenter fans, it's great to know that like Abrams was inspired to have that sequence with the headless Statue of Liberty in the film because he was inspired by the movie poster for Escape from New York, which is just wonderful. He said, "I wonder what a movie would be like with that," like meaning like, "Hey, we'll see how the Statue of Liberty head got here." And that's kind of that's a lot of fun. But let me ask you this question, because it's something that I'm really curious as a fan. Do you think the movie would have been more effective if they didn't show the monster as much?
Yes, but only slightly. I think there are a couple of really good kind of gimme shots of the monster, yeah. And I probably didn't need those. It probably would have been better to have it more in the shadows or just more of it. For anyone who hasn't seen the movie, the Cloverfield monster, they kind of look like giant praying mantises. They're big and thin, and they have these sort of pincers that come down. And then there are little smaller versions that run around and eventually grab some of our heroes. But it might have been a little – I would have been okay with not seeing it as much. I've just been like, okay, there's this something with giant legs that are landing and smashing things. But there are a couple of shots. Like there's one where they're in a helicopter where you see –
yeah,
a big juicy shot of what this thing looks like.
That's a terrific shot. I really have a problem with the shot at the end where basically the monster sneaks up on HUD as he's going back to get the camera, and it's a real kind of, it's the only part of the movie that feels fake, which is a crazy thing to say.
Right. Yeah.
But at that point, you know, the film has been enjoyable enough, and this is maybe 2 minutes away from the end that you go along with it. But I think part of that too is I'm not the biggest fan of Neville Page as a monster designer. I feel like this monster, his monsters for the 2009 Star Trek and the monsters he designed for Super 8 are all variations on a theme.
Mm.
And I don't particularly like the way these monsters look. And I feel if it had a better design, this movie would be, you know, it would be on a level of success as Godzilla if it just had a better design to it. And that's kind of the one flaw, I think, in this movie, is that the actual Cloverfield monster isn't perfect. You know, the design, if it were a little bit better, I mean, this movie, I think, would be held in a lot higher regard than it is, because I think a lot of people forgot about it.
Hmm. What do you think about the little bug ones, the little ones that run around? Because that almost feels like a little too easy to have another threat that, oh, yeah. There's also little bug ones that run around. And I mean, poor Lizzie Kaplan, who plays a woman who just happens to be at the party for kind of a really tangential reason.
Yeah.
And then gets caught up into this. She ends up really getting the whammy put on her by one of these little bug guys. And there's an extraordinary scene where she gets dragged. They find themselves in a military installation, not an installation, but like a camp, a pop-up hospital. That's exactly the phrase for it. And she's sick because she's been bitten. Or stabbed or whatever by one of these little bug creatures, and the army guys know she's going to get it, and they drag her off into like one of these hadmets, and just via silhouette, you see her just burst like a balloon. It's one of the most fantastic. When I saw it in the theater, like, oh no! Plus, I like Lizzie Kaplan; she seems so sweet, and then you just see her like the way that the movie dispenses with one of the main characters so sort of offhandedly is very upsetting.
And also, I mean, her and Hutt are the two most memorable characters in the film, too. Right. So it's just like it's a really sad moment. But I think getting back to your question about like the design of the parasite creatures, I like that a little bit more. But it felt even that felt a little Starship Troopery.
Yes. Yep. Yep. Yep.
But they were creepy. So I think, and also the, you know, them coming down the subway, it had a very, like, to me, it was very reminiscent of Aliens. So they definitely worked in that respect. But again, I just don't feel any of the monsters in this movie were what they could have been, you know?
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. One of the reasons this worked on me so well, again, when I watched it over the weekend, and I'm, like I said, I remembered liking it in the theater, but it just wasn't something I thought a lot about after I saw it. And then when I watched it again, I said, well, this is way better than I remember it, is one of the things that really terrifies me. And I'm sure this is true of anybody that lives in any sort of suburban or urban landscape, is the idea that, like, we like to believe that if a catastrophic event happens, and of course we've been through one in recent history,
right,
that somehow the structures that we have in place for society will keep us, if not safe, at the very least informed.
Right.
And I think it's obvious that isn't true. All that much. Right. I mean, when I lose my internet for a day, I lose my mind, you know, like I can't stay, you know. And so the idea that like society would hold together under something as unbelievable as a giant monster attack, it a movie that is able to convey that realistically,
yeah,
is to me very terrifying. And the scene again, where, when they look across the street and they're watching guys stealing TVs, it's so predictable that it's almost funny, but it's also sad too, because you're like, yeah, that's probably what would happen. There right. would be guys stealing TVs, despite the fact that the end of the world is approaching. But God, right. you know, I got to get a flat screen. You know, it's very upsetting to me.
And it's also like a coping mechanism too, because I mean, you raise like a really excellent point that, like, you know, it is kind of this delusion we all operate under that if something like this would happen, like society would kind of break down. I mean,
yeah,
like very, very rapidly. And you know, there are ways that we have to think to get through the day. And you know, this movie shows that breaking down very, very quickly, because hey, there's a big monster destroying New York City. But I mean, it does leave you with some food for thought after the movie's gone about, like, oh, what would happen if I was, you know, if I was in this situation? And then it makes you think, like, should I have a bug out bag and things like that?
You know? Right. Yeah. It's, I mean, you like to think the military will handle it. And you're like, eh, if a giant alien lands, there's really not much our technology is going to be right. able to do short of dropping a nuclear bomb. And that's not really a useful deterrent.
Right. Yeah. Especially in this movie.
Yeah. Well, right. Especially in this. Now, what do you think of what do you think of the cast? Like, what do you think of the actors? I was surprised when I saw I don't know if you were from how much you watch Mad Men, but I was surprised to see the actor who plays Ginsburg from Mad Men show up in this movie. He's only in a couple of scenes.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Ben Feldman. Yeah, and I'm like, Ginsburg. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And like, there he is. And it's like, I want him to be the main character. I want Ginsburg to be the main character of Cloverfield, because he would just lose his mind, you know. But yeah, I mean, they're you know, as you mentioned, the more interesting characters. T.J. Miller is the one, HUD, running the camera. Yeah, the main guys, Michael Stahl David and Jessica Lucas, they're kind of bland. They're impossibly good-looking people.
I kind of feel like that's by design,
mm-hmm.
because you don't want the main characters, who you know going into this are going to be monster bait. You don't want to. You don't want them to be too likable or too memorable, so that you really feel this sense of great loss when you come out of the movie, you know. And there's been, you know, there I know I've had conversations with friends and everything who are actively rooting for them because they see these characters as kind of like the symbols of gentrification within New York City.
Mm-hmm,
so they're kind
mm-hmm.
of rooting for the monster to take them down. So there's definitely there is that kind of aspect to the movie to enjoy as well. But yeah, I think they were kind of bland by design, because you don't want to have these characters who were going to take away from the monster, you know, because the monster, Clovey, is the star of the film.
Clovey.
You know, so you have, you know, so you have you have great people. Like, Lizzie Kaplan is always fantastic. And T.J. Miller, it's great to see him finally get some recognition for his work in Deadpool, because this is a guy who's been great throughout his career. So, you know, you put, like, the bigger, more engaging characters in the secondary roles because their deaths hurt more than the leads do.
Yeah.
You know, Lizzie Kaplan absolutely gets the best death in the film.
Yeah, I have to think that the they sort of sensed that she was the kind of the, I don't know, the draw is not the right word, but sort of the most interesting character, which is why I think they hired Mary Elizabeth Winstead for the sequel,
yeah,
because they're kind of the same type, you know, and
yeah.
I don't mean that as a knock. They're both very interesting actresses, but it's like, well, we can't bring back Lizzie Kaplan because she burst, so let's get Mary Elizabeth Winstead. I'm like, okay. Yeah, I mean, I even sort of buy the fact that HUD is carrying the camera through scenes that most people would not have done. I think you have to kind of accept the found footage movies as, you know, these people are going to be carrying cameras when they really shouldn't be. They would just drop it.
Well, and also, I mean, there is precedence. This did happen in real life. I mean, you know,
a monster attacked New York City? When did that happen?
on 9/11, I mean, people were documenting as much of it as possible. The French filmmakers. Now, obviously, they're filmmakers. You know, the ones who did I think the Gaudet brothers, I forget their name, but the guys who did that 9/11 documentary, you know, and I'm not trying to be glib about 9/11 by any point here, but it just shows that, like, God, I feel silly comparing 9/11 to Cloverfield. But, I mean, the point I'm making is, like, in people, in times of chaos, that people note that this is historical, given our, you know, photo-crazy and video-crazy times we live in. If an event like this happened, people would document it, because it's important for people to know what happened.
That's true. You know, I didn't even think about that. Just as a side thing, you're mentioning about that this movie came into some little bit of criticism because of the parallels to 9/11. I remember watching The Avengers in the theater, and at the end of that movie, there's all those scenes of destruction and event in New York City, and there's like the flyers put up for people missing their relatives, which is what happened in 9/11. And I had a kind of like dual feeling watching that. I thought, wow, we're actually using 9/11 imagery in an Avengers movie.
Yeah.
This is a movie with the Hulk in it, and they're referencing 9/11. And I thought, boy, that feels kind of cheap. And then the other part of me said, well, that's kind of how we process things, and maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's good that we're able to kind of deal with it by putting it in something sort of as absurd as an Avengers movie. I mean, you could say Cloverfield is just as absurd, but at least it has some level of a gut level realism to it.
Right.
In terms of how the people react. And I mean, it's again with the no music, and these are real locations. There's not sets. These are people running around. You know, if you're familiar enough with New York, you're going to recognize all of these places that they're running around in.
And especially like in the early sequence of the movie before, like after, you know, when after the what they initially think is an earthquake happens before the monster, that confusion is captured really well in the movie before it gets into the fantastical element of the monster attack. There, it really captures that what's going on, what's happening, that kind of fear and almost excitement in a weird way of hey, what's happening, you know. It's a weird thing that when, you know, that we live in this era that, you know, this cultural touchstone that was just awful is now being used in movies to kind of create a mood.
Yeah, I mean, again, I guess that happens with everything. You know what I mean? It's like World War II, and you know, every horrible thing that has happened eventually gets sort of grist for the mill. Not to be necessarily so dismissive of it, but
no, sure,
it just seems to be what happens.
Right.
Yeah, you know, the one thing I wanted to mention just as a throwaway too, because before I forget about it, is there's a reference when they're down in the sewer, not in the sewer, down on the train tracks, and HUD mentions, Lizzie Kaplan's character, Marlena, mentions Superman, and T.J. Miller's like, you know Superman? And he's like, you almost feel like he's flirting with her a little, which is boundaries. And she is very dismissive, like, yes, I've heard of Superman, because it's like, I live in the real world, you know, I live in the world. And am I crazy in thinking that is J.J. Abrams' nod to the fact that he wrote that much maligned Superman screenplay that got leaked on the internet? Am I crazy?
I don't feel you're crazy at all.
Okay.
I think that's probably – yeah, I think there's that too. And I actually think Lizzie Kaplan's whole character is kind of a an inversion and a twist on the whole manic pixie dream girl, because she kind of is that, but you know, she has like an edge to her, and it's also like, oh, you guys are gonna fall in love with the manic pixie dream girl. Well, here's what we're gonna do to her. You know.
Yeah, it is. It is. She's fat. She's great. She's a great actress, and she's gorgeous.
She's fantastic. She did this indie that the graphic novelist Jeffrey Brown, who's best known for his Star Wars work now, did called Save the Date a few years ago with Alison Brie from Mad Men. That's a really underrated movie. It used to be on Netflix. If it's still on there, I encourage anyone who's like a Lizzie Kaplan fan to check it out, because it's just this really sweet, hesitate to call it a romantic comedy because it's so much more than just a romantic comedy. It has some really interesting things to say about contemporary relationships, but she's phenomenal. She's an actress who just goes from one interesting project to another, and I really admire that.
That's cool. I've never heard of that movie. That sounds terrific. I'll have to get Alison Brie really and great. Lizzie Kaplan. Jeez. That sounds pretty
cool. She's a cartoonist in it, and all of her work is actually drawn by Jeffrey Brown, which is, I'm a Jeffrey Brown super fan. So yeah, I was big time into that movie when it came out. So yeah, it's fantastic. And it used to be on Netflix, if it still isn't, and it's on Amazon Prime, I'm sure too.
Wow, very cool. Yeah, I'm very happy to see that she's kind of like got bigger after. I mean, she was on Masters of Sex, and she's right, in other things, so she's kind of gotten her recognition. So that's really terrific. Yeah, you said she is great in this, and yeah, going back to your point a little bit about the main guy Rob is a bit bland. He is, he's kind of that Richard Carlson sort of guy, from the Creature of the Black Lagoon. He's kind of just straight ahead. Right. He would have been like 40 years ago. He would have been the guy in the Ray Harryhausen movie.
Exactly.
He's cut to contrast against all the special effects.
Yeah, everybody knows that it's not about him.
Right. But his goal to reach his girlfriend is sort of believable on a human level.
Yeah, it's noble. You would buy that too, because especially like, I mean that felt real, because I think if any one of us who were put in that situation and we knew we had someone who was in danger, we'd want to help them out.
Yeah, that's true. I like to think I'd be brave enough to venture. But yeah, what else are you going to care about at that point?
Right.
I mean, if you feel like the whole, especially when there is a sequence where they try and they are directed, the whole chunk of New York City are directed over this bridge. Which bridge is, do you remember which bridge is? Is it the Brooklyn?
I think it's the Brooklyn Bridge.
Brooklyn Bridge, right. And the creature just comes by and just cuts the damn bridge in half, killing Rob's brother.
Yeah.
And I mean, so there goes that idea, I mean, we're stuck now. I mean, I love the hell it sort of does, cut these people off from like, okay, you're really screwed here, because you're on an island. You're not going anywhere. You're miles away from any other place where you could get off, unless, of course, they run into the military, which is able to chopper some people out.
Right.
And even then, at the end of the movie, we're sort of spoiling for anybody who hasn't seen it, but too bad. But like when they get in the chopper, and they feel like they're getting away, and you hear HUD kind of like trash talking the Cloverfield monster. He's like, suck it, dude. And then, of course.
Yeah, they get whacked out. They get swatted out of the sky like a fly.
Yeah. I would not have done that. I would have been.
I wouldn't have trash talked till I was safely away.
Very circumspect. I mean, and so the movie ends in, as you mentioned, in Central Park under this bridge, and it's in the morning, which is another. I love that effect of that. This has gone on all night, and now it's the morning, and the damn thing is still rampaging.
Yeah.
And Rob talks to the camera, and he's with his girlfriend. He does retrieve his girlfriend, Beth, and they talk into the camera, and he basically comes to the realization he's going to die. And he talks into the camera and says, if you're watching this, then you survived. And then there's another explosion. The bridge collapses and they're buried under rubble. And that's it. Until, of course, the very final scene.
Yeah. When it flashes back to them in nicer times in Coney Island. And then something mysterious falls out of the sky and into the water.
That's such a terrific little nod.
It's so good.
Great.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's such a nice little thing. And it's done really subtly, too.
There's just like a splash out in the water above Coney Island. And, it's not like you see anything major. It's just like, that's weird. What is that?
What's that all about?
Yeah. Now, do you think now is the – so you believe – the Cloverfield, I guess, alien, the idea there is that it's an alien that has landed. It's not a creature that lives under the sea that has been awakened as if it's Godzilla or something like that.
I don't know. You know, I never got involved into the Cloverfield ARG stuff, which has a whole lot of explanation for Slusho, and which is the drink that pops up in –
Right, and all the J.J. Abrams things, yes.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of theories of where the actual monster came from, but I kind of have a, if it's not in the movie, it doesn't really exist kind of attitude. And I know that's going to alienate a lot of people who are really into
Cloverfield EU.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, before we start, I was talking about how I found out there's a Cloverfield manga and I'm obsessed with reading that now, but like, I like to, you know, I'm a fan of the, you know, of the viral stuff and the kind of peripheral stuff, but I also feel like if it's not on screen, it's not legitimately happened. That's the kind of like film viewer I am. The nerd in me kind of wants to fight against that, but that's, you know, that's just the way I feel. So I know there's a lot of theories for where it came from, but the information presented by the movie, I will say it's like, maybe this came from outer space. Maybe it was a spore. Maybe it was a spaceship. Maybe it was a satellite being downed. I don't know what is. It's just an interesting little postscript in the movie itself.
And the best thing is it doesn't matter.
Exactly.
It really doesn't matter.
Exactly.
It's the, you know, it just is that nice little like, wow, something weird happened, and then it all came loose, and there you go. You know. So yeah.
Yeah, and it engages your imagination. Like, well, that thing that fall from the sky, why did it fall from the sky? And you know, it makes you wonder about the origins of the creature. But that kind of stuff, like, I like the mystery of it. You know, I like being presented with just what the movie presents us with, and you're just as confused as to what the hell's going on and why as the main characters. And that is so effective to me.
Speaking of mystery, we all know that J.J. Abrams is in love with his mystery box thing. That's his whole sort of filmmaking MO. And he was able – this film was sort of done under the radar. Like I said, it was directed by Matt Reeves. I want to mention Matt Reeves. I think Matt Reeves is a terrific director. Am I crazy thinking that?
No. No, this movie, I mean, if you think about how the logistics of this movie and how it was pulled off, it's very, very successful. It's first off, I mean, it's an extremely – once everything starts, it does not let up. And to kind of keep that pace and not give the audience, you know, any kind of exhaustion or anything is a really increasingly rare thing to happen these days. But yeah, it is a beautiful done movie for the fact that it's, you know, working under the premise of, hey, this is just found footage. It's very well done.
Yeah. I mean, I went, you know, the couple of films Matt Reeves has done after this, which was Let Me In, which I thought was, I don't think Let Me In was
great. Yeah.
I don't think it was as good as Let the Right One In, but it is way better than it has any right to be.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I thought Rise of the Planet of the Apes was absolutely fantastic. It made me think, can this guy one of the Star Wars movies? This guy has got kind of a John Carpenter-esque sort of, like, he's not a I don't know what's the word, not visionary. I hate that term, but you know what I mean. Like he doesn't seem to have a fixed style. Like you have like a Tim Burton or a Chris Nolan.
Right.
He seems to be like almost like a Howard Hawksian utility player where he can
– He's kind of a chameleon. Yeah,
He can like, tell the story the way it needs to be told, and he
fits
his style based on that. And I think I'm like, this guy's a really underrated director. I've seen, I think, three or four of his movies now, and every one of them, I think, has worked on its own level.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, Rob. Now I'm thinking about a Star Wars film and how I would rather have him direct one than Rian Johnson.
I'm excited about Rian Johnson, not so much about Colin Trevorrow, but that's all other podcast. But I mean, I feel like Star Wars movies really work well with someone who is not an auteur. Is someone who is just makes the movie, you know, like a Richard Donner, a Howard Hawks, again, a John Carpenter.
Utility player.
Yeah, Yeah, a guy that just tells a story really well, effectively. Matt Reeves is that guy. I think he's working on the next Apes movie, so I guess he's locked into the world of the Planet of the Apes again with the Statue of Liberty heads there.
Right.
Back to that. Yeah. But anyway, I'm sorry. Just getting back to the mystery box. Yeah. In terms of getting this thing, you know, done under the radar, J.J. Abrams managed to pull that off again with the sequel.
Right.
I mean, yeah. I didn't know, not that I was following this any really closely, but I had no idea they were doing a Cloverfield sequel. I can't think of another time where you didn't know a movie existed until the trailer is ready. That never happens.
Yeah, it's pretty great. You know, I mean, are we calling this a sequel? That's the thing. Like, we won't know until later this week. And by the time this is out, I'm sure everyone will know the answer to it and either be very pleased or very disappointed. But J.J. Abrams is referring to it as a blood relative, and the tagline is "Monsters come in different forms." So I don't know what to expect from the sequel. What do you think it's going to be?
I believe that it's probably going to be the story as the world has been destroyed by the Cloverfield monster. I mean, the rampaging just kept going, and the world has been wrecked, and John Goodman is a survivalist, and he's managed to you know, hole up for himself underground, and the world above is ruined. And I don't know, you know, the context of why Mary Elizabeth Winstead lives there, but she obviously doesn't know. Maybe she gets, maybe she's got amnesia or some, you know, thing like that. But that's my sense of it, is that it is a movie that takes place in the world of Cloverfield after the Cloverfield destruction has gone on. So it's, yeah, it's a sequel, but it's not a sequel in that, oh, Rob, I survived. I'm here under the bridge and I got my camera again. It's not so much that. It's just one of those, you know, oh, there's some other characters that are affected by the events of the first film, which seems entirely reasonable to me. And it seems, again, from the trailer, a little more horror, I guess, maybe. Yeah. A little more thriller horror. All the nightmarish stuff that would go on being trapped in a room with this guy or something like that. But I'm really intrigued by it. I mean, I want to see it.
Yeah, I absolutely am super, super looking forward to it. I'm seeing it later this week, obviously. And just, like, I cannot wait. But one of the things that I'm kind of concerned about is, like, I'm wondering how I'm going to feel if it's just a real tangential relation to the first movie. And I don't know. Like, my gut feeling is we're not going to see the Cloverfield monster in this film.
I think so. Yeah, I would agree with that.
That's kind of, like, what my feeling is. And I don't know. Like, I think maybe we'll see a parasite, or I've read a bunch of potential spoilers. Like, there was a lot of Reddit controversy over the weekend about someone claiming to see the movie. I'm not going to get into that here because it's all online and everyone can debate it there. But my feeling is kind of that this will be a good movie on its own. And I'm going to try to just go into it with that, because I think the trailer looks fantastic and I love, like, Goodman and Winstead. So
yeah, that's two really good actors.
You know, and even if it is just like, hey, these two are trapped in a bunker and it's a battle of wills until the last third of the movie where it becomes some sort of weird monster attack, then I'm fine with that, you know, as long as I'm not too hung up on it being like a Cloverfield sequel, you know what I mean? Then I'll be okay with it. You know, like, I think it may have as much to do with Cloverfield as, like, Super 8 does, which is not anything.
right.
You know, but I think it's going to be a good movie in its own right. And I like that, like, what Abrams wants to do is, like, what Carpenter's original vision for the Halloween movies were. Mm-hmm, is just, like, set it around, loosely based around the same thing, but have it be different movies, which Carpenter tried with Halloween 3. And
Halloween 3.
Hated it at the time, and now people have gone back and really been like, hey, Halloween 3 is an interesting movie.
That's a great movie.
I love Halloween 3, actually. So, can we add Halloween 3 to the list of movies to do?
Is Karen Allen in that? If she's not, I'm not interested. I would love to talk about Halloween 3. That is a completely bonkers movie.
It's fantastic. But yeah, so I think what 10 Cloverfield Lane is going to be is just going to have the most tangential of links to the Cloverfield movie. And going into that, I'm prepared for that. So if the Cloverfield monster does actually show up, then I'll be really pleasantly surprised. But as long as I can, you know, enjoy it on its own merits, which is what I'm going to try to do and not get wrapped up. You know, because again, I know there's a bunch of people who are wrapped up in the, no, it's going to be the Cloverfield monster, but because of this happened with the, you know, the company that Goodman works for and this, that, and the other thing, and all this ARG elements that I think a lot of people who are hardcore into this are setting them up themselves up for disappointment. Whereas I'm just like, hey, if I enjoy it, then I enjoy it. So I think going into it, I'm going to kind of be like, okay, this is going to be a psychological drama with maybe some crazy monster shit at the end. That's kind of what I'm hoping for. And then I'll be fine with it.
Yeah.
Then I'll be fine with that.
That sounds terrific. Yeah, it really does. And it's like, I mean, what else? I mean, in a lot of ways, what else is there to do with the Cloverfield monster? I mean, what are you going to see rampaging in Ohio? Oh, no, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I mean, what is there left to do after he's destroyed New York?
I mean, I know the original concept for the sequel. I think they may even talk about on the audio commentary of the DVD is that they were just going to do the same attack, but by a different point of view, like another found footage thing. And I'm kind of really glad they didn't go with that, because that would have been kind of cool, but that's a novelty that will wear off very, very quickly. You know, and what are you going to have? Oh, here's another point of view of the Cloverfield monster destroying the Manhattan building. You know, like,
yeah.
It's just, you know, that would have been cheesy. So I'm much more into this kind of, if this is universe building, then so be it. You know, I would much rather have a completely different kind of sequel than something we've already seen.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's it marketing-wise, in terms of the fly in the face of what every studio wants to do, which is, you know, scope out, hey, guess what? In summer of 2024, we've got, you know, whatever coming out. It's the idea that you would be like, oh, hey, not only did we make a sequel you didn't know, it's coming out in a month.
Yeah, I think it was January 15th when this trailer, like, this trailer dropped. And everybody, I remember going, oh, shit, what? Huh? I had no idea, because, like, I had just assumed that, like, the Cloverfield franchise, it was a one and done. And, you know, like, I'm thrilled that it's going to continue in whatever form this movie is.
Yeah, it'll be very cool. It'll be very cool to find out. I'm really excited about it. So, I think, is that going to do it for Cloverfield? Do we have anything else you want to say about it?
Just go back and revisit it, because it's just as much fun now as it was in 2008.
I agree. It's a good, tough, nasty, fun little horror movie with some nice, realistic, some good performances and some stuff to really scare the hell out of you, which is what it's supposed to do. So, yeah, Cloverfield. Yeah. Good pick, Chris.
Thank you. Yeah.
Good job, man. That's excellent. So, anyway, thank you much for coming back on. I really appreciate it. I had a lot of fun. Where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me online on Twitter at Bionic Bigfoot.
We have that every time.
Also at Sci-Fi Explosion on Twitter. And on March 31st, I'm going to be appearing at Kevin Geeks Out talking about Superman versus Batman and in terms of what character had the better merchandise. The Kevin Geeks Out Superman versus Batman event at Nighthawk Cinema.
Very cool. Oh, boy. That would be interesting. Anyway, thank you so much for coming back on, man. I really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me. This is always a pleasure. I hope to talk to you with movies again, about movies again soon.
Absolutely. So, everybody, thank you so much for listening. As always, you can leave comments on the website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. If you want to leave a comment, just go right there. Or if you want to send an email, just go to the contact us page on the site. If you want to follow the show on Twitter, it's Film and Water Pod. And if you do, please use the hashtag FW Podcast. So thanks, everybody, listening. Thanks, Chris, for coming back. I really appreciate it. And until next week, that's a wrap.
Focused on being prepared. I saved your life by bringing you here. I knew this day would come.